This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this program, you get reporting on record-smashing late winter western heat in the U.S. And this is not a story about America. In the last 20 years, heat domes appeared over Europe, Russia, Canada, Iran, Japan, China, India, Australia, just to name a few. These stalled heat waves show up out of season and in new places. We are learning what they mean and what they cost the hard way, living through a new climate shift. Virtually Impossible Heat and the Future of the American West, journalists connect on yet another major climate disruption. We listen in to a media webinar hosted by David Dixon for Covering Climate Now. These are reports where summer heat breaks out in the winter, smashing thousands of all-time records. Real pros of environmental journalism try to express what it means, seasons never seen before.
My name is David Dixon. I'm a meteorologist and TV engagement coordinator with the nonprofit Covering Climate Now. For those of you that might be new to us here at Covering Climate Now, we are a global collaboration of more than 500 newsrooms all across the world, over 60 countries. We're organized by journalists, for journalists, to help us all do a better coverage of climate change and its local impacts. You can go ahead and head to our website, coveringclimatenow.org, to learn more and sign up for our newsletters, newsroom trainings, all of which are completely free of charge for journalists. I am so thrilled to see you all here today and also to have Climate Central partner with us for today's conversation. I encourage you to check out all of their offerings on their website. That's designed to power your forecasts, stories, and content that is used to make crucial links between extreme weather events and human-caused climate change to global audiences and even here in North America. Okay, I want to get right into it because we have a lot to talk about today and a great panel to help us facilitate the conversation and answer your questions. Now, it is my great pleasure to introduce the expert panel that we have assembled for this discussion for today, climate scientists, expert journalists as well. Please join me in welcoming them. First off, we have Rachel Becker, is a journalist reporting on California's complex water challenges and water policy issues for CalMatters. She's covered drought, water standoffs, groundwater depletion, water quality, and the world's biggest dam removal. Seth Borenstein is a national science writer for the Associated Press and is an adjunct journalism professor at NYU's Washington, D.C. campus. Recently celebrated, by the way, 20 years with AP. His work has gained numerous awards. Very glad that he is here. We also have Zach Labe, a climate scientist at Climate Central. His work aims to distinguish the differences and influences of climate change on the natural variability and to translate complex scientific findings into new insights for decision making. And last but certainly not least, we have Joan Miners, who is the climate news and storytelling reporter at the Arizona Republic, azcentral.com, since early in 2022. In America's hottest big city, she has covered the invisible, silent, deadly, and worsening threat of extreme heat. A lot of today's discussion is going to be forward-facing. You know, who cares about the weather over the past couple days? It might be lost and kind of forgotten in a month or so. Likely not, but regardless, it's important that we fully understand the significance of this historic heat wave and its climate connection. We all know it was hot, but the sheer scope and intensity of this out-of-season heat dome event is staggering. Between March 16th and the 23rd, over 1,500 daily high temperature records were set all across the United States. Of those, 660 were also all-time March heat records. Over 200 of those were set on a single day back last weekend. In Arizona, by the way, two communities reached 112 degrees Fahrenheit. That's, by the way, for our international audience, 44.4 degrees Celsius, smashing the highest March temperature ever recorded in the United States and was just a few degrees off of the hottest April temperature recorded in the U.S. On that same day, our colleagues at World Weather Attribution determined that this record heat was virtually impossible, that's a quote, without climate change. This attribution study, which you can find linked in the chat, found that the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas added at least 4.7 degrees Fahrenheit to this heat. These findings are staggering, but really not to be unexpected, as scientists have long been sounding the alarm on increasing devastatingly heat events being made all the more likely and longer lasting with climate change. As University of Victoria climate scientist Andrew Weaver put it, this is what climate change looks like in real time, extremes pushing beyond the bounds of what we once thought possible. Now, Zach, as a climate scientist yourself, what stands out in this heat wave in the context of climate change?
Yeah, I think, thanks, David. I think really two parts stand out to me that I'm going to continue to say over and over again. One being, it's only March. This out-of-season heat wave is just remarkable and eye-opening. We're talking about temperatures that are more similar to June and July across the Southwest. And so to keep reminding ourselves that it's still only March right now. The other is the persistence. You know, here we are, March 26th, and we're still talking about record high temperatures, even March record high temperatures, I was just checking, being shattered today. So this is a period that this heat wave has extended for 2 weeks or more, following what has been a record warm winter across the West and snow droughts. So it's just what we call in climate science, one of these compound events, meaning we have sort of two different extreme events back to back that really exacerbate impacts to communities and ecosystems. So from the climate change perspective, it's really been the persistence and just the out of season nature of the heat.
Rachel and Joan, how are you and your communities kind of dealing with this heat? We'll start with you, Joan, as you're in Phoenix, which again is no stranger to heat waves.
Exactly. I think it's important to note that Phoenix is in many ways kind of leading the response charge. We're developed, you know, since we've been dealing with extreme heat for so long, there are a lot of innovative heat response things happening here. And yet still we see hundreds of people die from heat-related causes every year. This year caught the Phoenix Heat Office off guard a little bit. They did not have their 24/7 cooling center ready to open quite yet. And so that does leave, we have a large unhoused population that does leave them out in the elements dealing with it. And the best that people can do, even though this is such a big thing and such a growing problem and so straightforward in many ways, the solutions are not always easy. I mean, the best they can do right now is kind of remind people to seek shade and monitor their exertion and wear light-colored clothing and drink water. So that's kind of where we are. This is definitely not business as usual. Today is actually the previous record for earliest 100-degree temperature in Phoenix, and that was set in 1988. So we just shattered a nearly 40-year record by over a week by having that first 100-degree day on March 18th. I spoke to a meteorologist at the Phoenix office in the National Weather Service who said that this was an atmosphere gone gangbusters. So I don't think they just say something like that. You know, meteorologists are known for being fairly, you know, cautious with what they say a lot of the time in their predictions, but they're calling this an atmosphere gone gangbusters. So I think that's notable.
Rachel, how are things doing in California?
It's been hot. It has been really hot. We've seen records broken across the state. My colleagues, Ana Ibarra and Alejandra Reyes-Bayarde, covering how public health departments are really kind of struggling to contend with the emergency management required around these early heat waves and around heat waves that are continuing to grow in California with climate change. One of the things that I've been looking at is how the heat wave is affecting the snowpack. I saw scientists calling this kind of early season heat wave where the warm temperatures persist at night, a snow eater heat wave, which is really challenging for the state's kind of major natural reservoir, which is the snowpack on the Sierra Nevada. This is kind of what the state's major reservoirs bank on to refill their supplies over the summer. But even with this heat that state's reservoirs are actually in decent shape because we're coming off of a few average to good water years, which is decent for California these days. And so the state's major reservoirs are really kind of brimming above historic averages and reaching capacity. But the challenge is that California's whole intricate, highly engineered water system is designed around this natural reservoir, our snowpack. And it's supposed to be at its deepest in April, but this heat wave is destroying it and destroying it rapidly. When I wrote about it last week, it was at 38% of average, and already, you know, less about a week later, it's at 23% of the April 1 average, and we've got almost a week to go. And what's really alarming is that it's even more dire in the Northern Sierra. It's at 8% of normal, and that's especially troubling because that's where the state's major reservoirs that send water to Central and Southern California are. So we're supposed to be having this water running down the mountain and into rivers and reservoirs when people and farms really need that water most, and that's not going to happen this year.
And we'll come back to that because that is a huge issue, and you covered a lot of it, this being described as a snow eater. I wasn't fully aware of the drop off from, you said, 39% and down to the 20s just in a matter of a week. It just goes to show how anomalous warmth like this really can chip away at the snowpack. But that's not the only cause that we've seen for that record low snowpack. Well, but I want to hear from you, Seth. Seth, you're a little bit further displaced. You're back on the East Coast with myself, but you have reported on many, many heat waves, including that 2021 Pacific Northwest one, if we remember, which killed hundreds both in the U.S. and across the border in Canada. And you actually even recently compared the two with an article published earlier this week talking to a scientist. In fact, I think it was like a weather historical expert. What did you learn, and what makes this heat wave different from other heat waves that we've come to kind of expect over the past couple of decades?
I think more interesting to me is what does this and the Pacific Northwest heat wave have in common? And they are just so off the chart in terms of the calendar or the atlas. I mean, this is the calendar. Pacific Northwest was the atlas because you just don't get heat waves like that. What I started to work on in talking is, you know, when we look at heat waves, you either measure it by intensity, how high temperatures get, but then that doesn't really fit with something on where the timing is off like this, where it's just months early, or in the Pacific Northwest, where it's just in the wrong place. And so trying to figure just this level of weirdness is hard. I mean, in what can this be compared to? And the Pacific Northwest is one. The Russian 2010 heat wave is another one to look at. March 2012, we had March heat wave in the central United States that wasn't quite like this. One of the things to look at is to take a step back and say, not just looking at the heat dome in the Southwest, but you have the incredible and horrendous flooding and rain in Hawaii. And there's actually, not only is it the connection with the jet stream and the same blocking pattern, but if you look, some of the heat that gets into the atmosphere when rain is formed, diabatic heating is what they call it, that helps trigger, and Zach would be better on this than me, by all means, but there's a relationship between these extremes. And it's just, to me, the fascinating thing is trying to find how we're getting more of these extremes. And one of the things I've been told over and over again is that, well, weather models did a great job predicting this a week in advance. Climate models routinely underpredict for, you know, when they look at scenarios, they underpredict extremes like this.
Anything to add to that, Zach?
Oh, a lot of points. Seth did a great job at summarizing them. And I totally agree. So we've been talking about actually since early March that this is going to be a major story for a lot of the country. And it turned out, I think temperatures were even higher than I think most of my colleagues could have ever guessed they would have reached this month. But again, the climate model struggle, trying to understand how does this fit in the perspective. We know that heat extremes are increasing. We know that the long-term temperature trend is also rising in the background. We also know that spring is arriving earlier. We can see it in the data. We can see it in like plants when they're blooming as well. But capturing these types of extreme events is still very challenging due to all the moving pieces and the physical mechanisms. And so far, the observations are showing that these heat extremes are increasing more quickly than our climate model is projecting. So there's lots of new exciting research to try to answer this question, new technology, new high resolution models, new AI machine learning parts, but it still is quite a challenge. And so I think these case studies like this one we just observed will be studied probably for years, trying to understand the drivers of this heat wave and how we can better represent them going forward into the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some climate scientists are already kind of predicting that this heat wave might go down as the most anomalously extreme heat wave ever recorded any time of year in the southwestern U.S. So all this to say, there's a reason there's been so much attention due to this heat wave, even though, and correct me if I'm wrong, I haven't seen many reported deaths with this heat wave. A part of it kind of comes with it early in the season, the preparedness of the areas already impacted by this. But even if this event, which is unlikely going to be as deadly as other summertime events, it's vital that we don't downplay its danger. Extreme heat is the number one weather-related killer in the U.S. and across the world, outpacing floods, hurricanes, even severe storms, which we know make all the headlines. Because we also know that even abnormal warmth can pose a serious threat to the most vulnerable, particularly as Joan mentioned, the unhoused and those with medical conditions such as schizophrenia. Now, as I said earlier, a lot of this session is going to be forward-facing because meteorologists expect while these record-breaking temperatures, this heat dome essentially is going to continue through, for some, through the weekend, and we're still going to see anomalous warmth for probably a couple weeks with this overall pattern. Relatively cooler weather is going to return, but the impacts from this event might linger long afterwards. And we've already kind of heard it. A lot of the concern about this heat wave is the impact it has on water scarcity in the drier summer months. As Rachel mentioned, April 1st is typically when we expect mountain snowpacks to be at their fullest. Yet that historic snow drought throughout this season, even before this snow melter of a heat wave, have left snow reserves far below historical averages. Now, Rachel, you mentioned that despite this, again, the state's reservoirs are in good shape, but that only kind of tells a little bit of the story. Can you explain exactly who really benefits from the snowpack compared to the reservoirs, which we're going to get into in a little bit later on?
Yeah, so the kind of the major challenge for most of California's reservoir operators is that the reservoirs play these kind of dual roles. On the one hand, they need to stopper flood flows, and on the other hand, they need to store water for the drier months ahead, and sometimes these roles conflict. We saw that in really dramatic fashion in Lake Mendocino during the 2012-2016 drought, where pretty rigid federal operating rules required Lake Mendocino to release water after these very wet December storms to make room for floodwaters that then never materialized, which caused pretty dire shortages in the basin and kind of led to a rethinking of how these reservoirs are operated and some experimental programs that incorporate more short-term forecasts and weather outlooks into reservoir decisions. So some other reservoirs in California are kind of looking at this program, considering it, piloting it. But in the meantime, many have to ask for special permission from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in order to store water in that safety barrier, that flood control space. So as a result, for reservoirs that are at or above historic averages right now, because it's still, you know, spring, they have to leave room. And so that's leaving that early snow melt rushing by, whereas if it had melted on a more I can't say typical as things are changing so rapidly, but if the snowpack had melted kind of as we'd have expected historically, that flood control space would, they would no longer have to maintain it. And, you know, people would be using that water for cities and farms. And so there would be room. And so the reservoirs would be replenished. And that's not going to happen this year. So even though we're going into the summer with really decent levels in the reservoirs, they're not going to be refilled. And so that leaves the next water year really an open question and puts California potentially in a not great spot as we also think about squeezes on the Colorado River.
And that kind of goes right into my next point. You know, Lake Powell is a quarter full. Colorado River running at around, I think, 38% of average inflow. And you mentioned the Colorado River and kind of the conversations around that with guidelines set all the way back in 2007 to help regulate water distribution and manage water levels in times of drought, set to sunset at the end of this year. I'm curious to hear from you, Rachel, given that this event, again, has been described as this is what climate change looks like. Do you think this is going to factor into discussions as we head into summer months?
It's anyone's guess what's going to factor into these discussions right now. But certainly the conditions are ratcheting up the tensions. I mean, as you said, Powell is 25% full. You know, it's flirting with minimum power pool in the near future. Experts are worried about damage to dam infrastructure if it gets too low. We got Lake Mead at 33% full with a pretty abysmal snowpack in the basin. And that's especially concerning when you consider that even when snowpack has been decent in recent years, runoff has been paltry. You know, thirsty soils, the thirsty atmosphere have been really drinking it up before it gets into the reservoirs. So tensions are high, and instead of focusing in this kind of long-term view of how to manage the river, the negotiators have their attention sort of split on dealing with this near-term potential crisis situation, and then also the longer term planning. And in the meantime, you know, it's kind of murky still what the sort of federal alternative is and what the federal consequences are going to be if the states fail to reach a deal. So it's kind of a tense moment on the Colorado River.
To put that lightly, of course, and it is a growing story. It's a huge story. I'm seeing some great reporting come out of it, but both with CalMatters and other. And this is a key point, again, about climate change. It's a threat multiplier with cascading impacts. You mentioned it, Rachel. Take, for example, snowpack. It's feeding same water, providing drinking water to those in Phoenix. It irrigates farms, feeding 40 million people. It generates hydroelectricity at Lake Powell, which cools those AI data centers you've heard a lot about and lowers wildfire risk. It's all connected, and climate change plays a key role. Now, speaking of wildfires, earlier this week, a new study further investigated the link between a declining snowpack and more severe western fires in the western part of the U.S. In it, the authors found that not only does early snowmelt drive not only more fires, but more damaging ones. We kind of understand this with climate change. The thirstier atmosphere, the warmer it gets, it creates conditions more conducive for wildfire spread. And Joan, you are an avid outdoorsman, avid skier. You even biked all across the Arizona Trail. So you have a really great kind of lens of what this landscape looked like. What are the fire risks? In fact, you even investigated an area that was impacted by wildfires somewhat recently. What are kind of the concerns in these areas, and what have you seen kind of personally as well?
From a skiing perspective, this was a terrible year, more so than even recent terrible years. There's just no snowpack to speak of in the West. Obviously, we don't cry too many tears for like the skiers. It's not the primary area concern, but I do think it's notable to mark this occasion as a sign of the decline of winter and shifting times. There was a study that found that sites that have hosted the Winter Olympics in the past, only about half of them are going to be suitable for future hosting of those events by 2050, which is really only a few Winter Olympics away. And then, of course, like Rachel was saying, when we have minimal snowpack in the first place, and then it melts faster and we lose it earlier in the year, it's not wetting the soils and being on the landscape for a longer period of time into the spring and summer. And so now we're looking at what's honestly going to be a really scary, dry summer in the West. And we already saw last year nearly 200,000 acres right north of the Grand Canyon burn between two different fires in July and August. And I went up and talked to business owners and firefighters and people that work on the trails in those areas. And I rode my bike through the burn scar, and it was a really shocking devastation that was partially, and it's interesting, the conversation around that gets so muddied because it is partially because of management and limited prescribed burning in the past and a buildup of fuels on the landscape and all of these different changes. But it is doubtless also related to a warmer temperatures, including warmer overnight temperatures, which don't allow the plants to do gas exchange while maintaining their moisture. And it's just all of these cascading related things. I just want to add one thing about the risks of extreme heat is that, you know, we've also seen increased 911 calls. And when those come in because of heat and when heat is taking up more of the year, it's put strain on emergency medical systems that delay response times to other calls. So I think that's just like an important thing. And there was a study that came out about that recently to keep in mind.
In a selection from a webinar, March 26, 2026, hosted by a journalist group covering climate now. Find a link to the full one-hour gathering in my show blog at ecoshock.org or coveringclimatenow.org. Next week, I talk with one of America's great meteorologists and storm chaser, Dr. Jeff Masters. Jeff brings out the scope, the numbers, and the awe of the march of heat in the West in 2026. Tune in for sure.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Is this outbreak of insane war violence the new normal? If we can't keep our greenhouse gases down to nature's level, humanity is doomed to a continuing hot and violent future. This harsh news comes from a team of scientists in Austria. Dr. Thomas Gasser is a senior research scholar with the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis. Thomas coordinates the Earth System Modeling Research Team. He helped develop a new program that is more realistic to the way nature really works. Gasser is lead author of one new paper and co-author of another, laying out our long future risks. From Luxembourg, Austria, Thomas Gasser, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
Yeah, it's good to connect with you. So we last talked in 2018 about feedback from the thawing Arctic permafrost. And recently, you and your colleagues are back with new work on the implications of long-term feedbacks. What got you working on these problems?
Well, I think essentially two aspects that really were consequences of the previous work on permafrost. The first one is that since we had focused on one of these long-term impacts of climate change, permafrost thaw, we wondered whether some of the conclusions we got would be the same with another long-term impact. So we wanted to derive more robust conclusions from our work. The second aspect actually is also related to permafrost, but goes much broader than this, is the notion of uncertainty. And so the two papers we are going to discuss consider this notion of uncertainty and explore what we can do with this uncertainty and what kind of decisions can be taken despite the uncertainty.
Okay, well, let's begin with your new paper published February 26th, Negative Emissions to Mitigate Earth System Risks, It sounds like governments are expecting one knob to control the whole temperature, but Earth systems are not one thing. Thomas, what was missing from the picture we have been using for decision-making about the future?
So I want to insist first on the fact that we know a lot about the Earth system, and we understand the major processes and the reasons for the global warming we are seeing today. And we are integrating more and more of what we scientists call the second-order processes, so more and more feedbacks in the system, consideration of more subsystems of this broader planetary system, and we are getting a better and better picture. But what remains true is that we have a lot of uncertainty to deal with when we consider a quantitative description of the Earth system and its different components. And so what was really missing, or what is still missing when we discuss what is the best decision to take given the current state of knowledge, is how to deal with this uncertainty. It is how to decide, given that for some aspects we are really not sure what the exact number is. For instance, how much carbon will be released by permafrost in the future. We know carbon will be released by permafrost, but we're not quite sure how much, and the uncertainty is relatively huge. So, of course, scientists are working to reduce this uncertainty, but the question we were asking in that paper specifically was, given the current state of knowledge, given this uncertainty, what could we still decide? What is the best decision right now, given that?
Yes, we can't wait for perfect answers because the Earth system is changing underneath of us. So many of our expert guests on Radio EcoShock tell us long-term processes in nature are unlikely to stop whether we control emissions or not. Thomas, talk to us about the importance of time-lagged impacts.
Time-lagged impact is maybe a bit of a jargon word. It really means those long-term, slow impacts that occur after a long term, after having, for instance, emitted carbon dioxide. So the climate system involves the whole planet and is a very, very slow system. So we will see only in the long future the impacts of what we are doing today. And this is of course important for various reasons. First of all, because it also means that nowadays we are seeing the impact of what we did even several centuries ago. But as we are disturbing the system more and more and faster, we expect to see even more of those time-lagged impacts in a faster fashion. But it's also important for questions of intergenerational equity, a question that we have to consider the future generations and what our current actions are doing or will do to these future generations.
In fact, your group finds we will have to remove more carbon from the atmosphere for hundreds of years?
Essentially, yes. And this is really because of those slow lagging impacts, is that right now, even if we stopped emitting right now, we would see the atmosphere would keep warming up, and even after the temperature roughly stabilizes, we would still see those time-lagged impacts. Permafrost would continue thawing, and especially sea level would continue rising. And so, what we explored and is that, if we actually want to limit those long-term slow impacts, we shouldn't just stop emitting. We really have to remove carbon, CO2 especially, from the atmosphere.
Glaciers will melt, sea levels will rise for centuries, permafrost keeps thawing, oceans release heat. If there's nothing we can do to stop that now, why go through the social and economic pain to rearrange everything into the low-carbon ways?
Yeah, I think this is really the key question. I think it's really important to understand that climate change and impacts from climate change are not a binary issue. It's not it's happening or not. It's not we are winning or not. It's not we passed the point and we should give up everything. It's really every fraction of a degree matters. And so we should always consider what could be done to improve the situation. Yes, sea level will rise, permafrost will thaw, oceans will release the heat they have accumulated if we stop emitting CO2, but capturing this CO2 from the atmosphere would lower the impact and would compensate at least some of that and perhaps all of it, if we want to be optimistic. So again, what is important is that every bit counts, and even capturing, if we manage to do this technologically, I should say, capturing carbon from the atmosphere would reduce those impacts.
Thomas Gosser, let's move on to another paper you co-authored and published January 2026. The title is Stabilizing Time-Lagged Climate Impacts Requires Net Negative Emissions for Centuries. So that's sort of what we've been talking about. Your new results show we need to get to net zero CO2 emissions a decade earlier than previous estimates. That's new to me, and that could mean just 15 years to stop loading up the atmosphere. You investigated four scenarios. What is the best we can hope for, starting from where we are today?
That's a very difficult question you're asking here. I cannot say what is the best we can hope for in terms of what humanity will be doing or what we can hope humanity will be doing. It's very, very difficult to... It's essentially predicting the future, right? So that's not what we do, obviously. When we do science, we investigate, we make scenarios. And in those scenarios, we are... in that specific paper, we are looking at some number of risks, and especially risks related to not being able to remove CO2 from the atmosphere, or at least not as much as we think we could do right now. And we investigate, and basically this is why we conclude that we have to reach net zero earlier than in other studies, is that given the fact that there is a risk that we will not be able to develop the technology to remove CO2 from the atmosphere, then we have to curb down emissions as soon as possible. But what I cannot tell you is what will happen, obviously. And so, of course, stopping emissions entirely within the next 15 years seems extremely daunting, and you have to be quite optimistic to assume this will happen. But again, we investigated more like what if questions rather than just what will happen.
Well, absolutely. So what if we go above 3 degrees C, for example, 3.5, even by 2100? What does your worst case scenario suggest will happen? I know this is not future telling, but what would the scenario suggest?
I think we have the answer to that question in just the previous IPCC reports. We know the rather pessimistic scenarios that you're describing, something like 3 to 4 degrees by the end of the century, lead to significant impact on the ecosystems, on the society, especially on the most vulnerable within each society. And yeah, we know that this is what would happen. But again, I want to insist on the fact that every fraction of a degree counts. So if we can find ways, even if the initial pathway we are taking is not the one, is not the most optimistic one, is not the best one, we should always make an effort and consider that fighting or like reducing emissions and removing CO2 from the atmosphere can only lead to benefit in terms of impacts all across all possible sectors and, again, ecosystems and for humanity as well.
Well, trying to get there, this new paper considers legal ways of controlling emissions, the law, and it starts with a July 2025 decision by the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, and the court found climate treaties already signed by nations imposed binding obligations on those states to protect the climate system. What does their ruling mean?
First of all, a disclaimer, I'm not a lawyer, but our understanding of the ruling, and I think this is a shared understanding across the scientific community, is that if a country has signed a climate treaty, they have committed to protecting the climate system itself, because essentially more climate change, more global warming, means more damage to the people. So it is really just this link that is fully recognized by the International Court of Justice between, in this case, emission of greenhouse gases and the damages and how harmful it is on the people.
But as we know, among the major powers, the United States, Russia, China, and India, they have not accepted compulsory jurisdiction of that International Court of Justice. So this climate ruling is not accepted or being enforced by the world's largest polluters?
That is absolutely true. And there's not much we can do about that, at least on the short term. We use, in that paper, we do quote the decision from the International Court of Justice, but really as a motivation to explain that if we want to follow that logic, the ruling itself, we have to limit those time-lagged impacts. We have to limit specific climate impacts to avoid damage to the people, to society. Of course, the major powers you cited do not recognize the International Court of Justice. One could still imagine, perhaps, that national Supreme Courts or equivalent could, at some point in the future, come up with a similar conclusion, you know, a similar decision. But at this stage, there is indeed nothing to actually, no entity, no global governance or global entity that could enforce such a decision.
Well, suppose we get international action, and I think it will happen with enough climate pressure. How do time-lagged impacts work into the responsibilities for wealthy and heavy polluting countries that they bear to help the future?
Time-lagged impacts work in two ways in this sense. Wealthy, heavily polluting countries have been emitting greenhouse gases for decades and centuries even. And so it means that they have been impacting the climate already, and what they have done in the past and will do in the future will keep impacting in the future as well. And so one aspect is what we call loss and damage. It's essentially, to simplify, financial compensation for the damage of the most vulnerable countries need help that can be financial or otherwise to adapt to climate change or also help to mitigate and avoid following the same pathway that richer countries have taken. So that's one aspect. It's something we discussed actually in a third paper some years ago with the same group of authors, is the notion of carbon removal obligations. That's something that does not actually exist right now, but that could be a international system to force emitting countries and heavy polluters to produce carbon capture in the future. The idea is to say that if a country has been emitting a lot of CO2, it has a debt, essentially, and we could imagine an institution that could control that debt and, assuming some way of enforcing it, could tell countries that how much they have to capture to actually balance that debt, because countries have been putting CO2 in the atmosphere for their own economic development, and the idea is that now they have an obligation to remove it. So rich, heavily polluting countries then within such a system would have in the future to remove carbon from the atmosphere because they have been heavy polluters.
A new industry for the UK and America and Germany and many other countries. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is research scientist Thomas Glaser from Austria. We're talking about the long future of carbon capture that we're forcing on future generations. So, Thomas, in addition to the permafrost thaw and the rising seas, which I think you studied in depth, we have oceans releasing massive heat since the Industrial Revolution. Arctic ice will continue to shrink, and that reduces Earth's albedo, which is often left out, and so more solar energy comes in. You've got so many things. I mean, land and ocean sinks may weaken. Does this paper manage to consider these other factors, or is that still work to be done?
So of the different factors you cited, that actually the paper does, or like our work does, consider all of them. Ocean heat release, Arctic ice melt, and change of Earth albedo, for instance. These two are fairly well understood processes. So most climate projections now include these. We also consider the weakening of the future land and ocean carbon sinks. Again, of course, there is uncertainty in those factors, but this is exactly what we looked at, is what decisions can we take given the uncertainty of those factors. So I'm actually quite proud to say that we have, of course, not all existing factors or feedbacks in the system, because we keep finding some of them, but again, the main ones, the first order processes, we included them in our study.
With unstoppable problems like sea level rise, we get strange effects. For example, is it true that future societies working to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere will see less and less benefits as they keep going decades and centuries later?
Well, the Earth system is a complex system. And as we've already discussed, it has a lot of inertia, a lot of those slow processes that keep happening a long time after any perturbation first happened, like emitting CO2, but also removing CO2. So the answer to your question really depends on what we call the removal profile itself, that is, how much effort would be done to remove at what time. But if we really want to avoid those long-term impacts, we really have to remove for a long period of time. And so the benefits, we would see some benefits immediately, but benefits would accumulate as well over time, as long as there is removal happening. But it is true that then if we stop removing, then things will again slowly reach a new, what we call a steady state. And so the marginal benefits would decrease. But again, this is only after stopping the removal activity. And what we concluded in those two studies we've been discussing is that we need to remove for a long period of time, probably a whole century, during which we have to keep removing CO2 from the atmosphere.
How does the problem of time-lagged impacts compare to the logic used in overshoot, where global temperature allegedly reaches a dangerous point but then comes back down as humans remove massive amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere?
So there are two ways those two notions really interact. The time-lagged impact impacted by the overshoot, in the sense that if we overshoot our temperature targets, say we are aiming at what? We were aiming at 1.5 degrees C. And if we overshoot that temperature and then go down, to go down, I have to insist we need to capture CO2 already there. There's no way to lower the temperature without capturing CO2. But so if we go above our target, those impacts will be more than at the target level. Say we reach 2 degrees instead of 1.5, obviously we will have more climate impact. But what will happen then is that it will make overshooting even more difficult, in the sense it will make going back down more difficult. Because it will, for permafrost thaw, it's a very clear process, because this releases more greenhouse gas in the system. It means that if we get above the temperature target, we will get even more CO2 and methane in the atmosphere than anticipated, and therefore to bring back the temperature to the target level, we will need to capture even more CO2, for instance. So there is a clear interaction between those two notions.
The paper warns, quote, "Delays to earlier mitigation not only raise the median impact level, they also increase the spread of projected outcomes." Please explain what that means.
Again, this relates to the notion of uncertainty, but we often talk about temperature change in the future by climate change with just one number. We say, you know, 2 degrees, 3 degrees. But this is often the median impact level. So this means that it's a 50% chance of being higher than this, but also a 50% chance of being lower than this. What we looked at also is what we call the spread of the outcome, meaning the uncertainty on this, and especially the higher, the most extreme outcome. And what we concluded is that if we delay mitigation, yes, we do increase the median impact level, as we discussed previously, for instance, say if we don't act fast enough by the end of the century, we will reach 3 degrees of global warming. But the more extreme case, that is less likely, but still a chance of it happening, would be in proportion more than the change in this medium impact level. So say between early mitigation and late mitigation, we reach the median level reached is 3 degrees instead of 2 degrees, but maybe an extreme possible outcome would be 5 degrees instead of 2.5. So the difference increases for those extreme outcomes. So this is what we meant by this statement, and I hope I made it clear.
Actually, you did make it clear, and I appreciate that. Now, another difficult thing to talk about, that technique that you use in this paper, and I think listeners would just fade out when anybody talks about Bayesian analysis. In fact, big business and bankers use this technique to quantify risk management, whether they call it that or not. And this type of inference requires three steps. We begin with a starting state of historical data and beliefs. And then we update that as new data arrives. And finally, we make decisions despite the uncertainty, which is something we've been talking about. Is that not happening, all those stages with the global climate models and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessment reports?
Well, it is happening, but in a way not fully. So it happens with the purely physical science, so the pure knowledge we have of the climate system. Of course, we update that knowledge with new information, and we get a better understanding of the climate system and its potential response in the future. But it's not fully happening when we design scenarios, when we try to quantify what is the best decision to make given this uncertainty. And we managed to bring in some notion of uncertainty and some of the Bayesian principles, but it's actually very difficult to do for purely technical reasons. It requires essentially a lot of computation power to fully solve, the system to get the proper answer that would fully respect the Bayesian principle. And so this is what we did in that study, but we had to do something is to simplify many aspects of the system down to essentially the core, some core equations that we know are physically and economically meaningful to be able to solve it mathematically.
You and your colleagues created a new model to include uncertainties about climate and humans will react. Tell us about Pathfinder.
Yeah, maybe the name is a bit on the nose, but Pathfinder is a simple model of the Earth system that has been built with really the idea of exploring pathways, future pathways, and exploring ideally all of them, which sounds impossible because there's an infinite amount of pathways, but we are still designing ways to do so from a purely mathematical perspective. And so this relates to my previous answer. This is really a model that is mathematically simple, but accurate enough that we can describe the key components of the Earth system, including some aspects of the socioeconomic system. And so this is a model that we've been using to explore a large number of scenarios and to try to reduce or to bracket what possible future could be, but also what decisions should be taken, given a number of assumptions and availability of technologies, as I mentioned, and given objectives of limiting climate impact, for instance.
It seems even with the best new techniques, results are still a best guess, given huge uncertainties about both climate and what humans might do in particular. And I can picture governments saying, well, come back when you really know what's going to happen. Should we wait for more science and better models before we make serious decisions on the climate?
No, we should not wait. And that's exactly the point we're making in that first paper we discussed. It's really that, of course, nowadays there are uncertainties and there will always be uncertainties. But if you just wait for everything to be certain, we don't take any decision. So the best is actually is to consider these uncertainties within the decision, basically. And there's a lot there's a field of research that is called decision theory, and there are a lot of principles and let's call them algorithms to take decisions given the uncertainty, and this is what we have explored there. Really, we know enough to take decisions now, but also we can include all these uncertainties into the decision to come up with the best decision given what we know nowadays.
Saving the climate, it sounds like, requires institutions that can endure through centuries, no matter what political or personal changes may happen. And this is a challenge humanity has never really met. What are the limits we are leaving for the many generations to come?
Yeah, you are absolutely right, Alex. This is a challenge that has never been met by humanity. We are facing climate change. It is a new challenge for humanity. But I think it also means it requires new solutions, essentially. And we are quite convinced that this requires new institutions. And of course, when you look at the state of the world nowadays, talking about global institutions seems absolutely crazy. But nevertheless, we don't see any other way to tackle the problem. Of course, we also need the bottom-up approach. But when our conclusion is that we have to remove CO2 from the atmosphere for centuries, we don't see any other way for it to happen than actually having some sort of global governance that would make sure that it is happening, because no one, as an individual, no one can do that. And of course, this has implications for future generations, but I think it's exactly why it should be done, essentially, because the future generations will benefit from this global governance and global institutions.
What are you working on now?
We are following up on this idea of uncertainty, really. This is a big topic of research for us now. And one of the things that we want to look at is actually this notion of overshoot we have discussed. Now that we have all but passed the 1.5 degree threshold, the whole scientific community is talking about overshoot. The big question is how do we go back to that level? But a lot of the solutions that are proposed at this stage are called nature-based solutions. They rely a lot on reforesting, on doing bioenergy, growing bioenergy crops, and burning them for energy and capturing the CO2 from the burning and storing it in geological storage. And these sort of technologies that are not fully developed. What we would like to look at is how much climate change impacts the availability of those technologies, because we are talking a lot about overshooting, that is going back to 1.5 or even below, but I think it is an open question whether we can actually do that, and I think it has a lot of implications also for adaptation. Because I am personally, and as a scientist, I am a bit afraid that the whole community will look at the question of overshoot, I'm afraid we will give the impression, we will convey the idea that we can do it. And I think this is an open question right now, whether we can.
From the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Austria, we've been speaking with Dr. Thomas Gasser. Find links to the new science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. It is all open access, free. Thomas, thank you for leading us into this long future.
Thank you, Alex.
Tune in next week for another vision of the new climate. Dr. Jeff Masters helps us get the facts on the Great Western Heat Dome of 26 and more. But the heat was not alone. Along its northern boundary, an outlandish amount of water tumbled from the sky, flooding parts of Hawaii, and then poured in atmospheric rivers over Canada's west coast. This was a double-edged system so large we barely comprehend it. Seth Bornstein noticed it. Weather West host meteorologist Daniel Swain watched it. And this is not the first appearance of the terrible twin weather system. Next week, my friends. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about the real world.